You are listening to Punk News Podcast, episode 496. Back to the Punk News Podcast. This is Features Editor John Tiller. We got a special episode for you tonight. We are here with a special guest. Before we mention our special guest, let's talk about the usual crew of bruisers. We are here with contributing editor Adam White. Adam White, it's your wife's birthday. What are you doing on the podcast? You should be celebrating your wife and thanking her for putting up with you.
Yeah, I know. I was totally going to flake. And then I realized that that was both going to be rude to my wife and rude to you guys. And I'm already being rude to my wife, so I'm just trying to be rude to the least amount of people at a given time. So that's where we are right now.
Fair enough. That person laughing is M. Moore, news editor who's doing an awesome job. M. Moore, have you ever had someone important in your life forget your birthday, and what did you do about it?
Oh, all the time, because I don't talk about it, so no one knows, and that's how I know who, like, my real friends are.
What day is your birthday? I'm going to write it down right now.
It's April 25th.
Oh, we just missed it. Oh, no, I did.
No, you did you did a post for it.
Yeah, that's right. We did. So we did wish M a happy birthday. And we are also here with a special guest. We are here with Jason Hall of Western Addiction. Big time Punk News favorites, the Punk News readers and podcast listeners are big fans of Western Addiction. The band's nearing their 20th year. Jason Hall, what's happening?
All right. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, Jason, let's kick off a song. When we come back, we'll interview you a little bit and see what's happening in your world. Jason, what song should we play from your brand new album?
How about the title track, Frail Bray?
All right. This is Frail Bray by Western Addiction, their third album and second in about, I mean, their third album and in about 20 years and their second since, I guess, the reactivate. Anyway, this is Western Addiction.
Okay.
And we're back, and that was Western Addiction's title track from the new album that's out right now. Jason, we're going to talk about the new album, but the first question is, I know we're going to be great pals, and here's why. Jason, you are a big fan of AC/DC's Live at Atlantic Studios album, which is a relatively rare AC/DC album.
I do like that one. I like it a lot.
Well, let's talk about it. Why is that a special album in the AC/DC au revoir?
I mean, I have a lot of AC/DC DVDs and live shows from like the Bon Scott era. I mean, that's as real as band as you get. You can hear missed notes, which is awesome. And Angus Young is one of the best guitar players ever, but I just love how real it is. And I like how it sounds odd, but the breath around the notes of AC/DC songs where they're not perfectly played, but it doesn't matter. And it's actually better that it's not perfectly played. And it just feels so real and like a real band sound.
And we're going to connect that to you in 1 second. But before we get to that, Jason, I am a mega AC/DC fan. I'm a huge fan. I like all eras. I think Bon Scott's the best. But, you know, Brian Johnson's pretty – I mean, what can you do following Bon Scott? Brian Johnson did a pretty good job. But, you know,
yeah, he did a great job.
AC/DC is a very divisive band among punk rockers. Some punk rockers see AC/DC as, you know, stupid cock rock that the jocks like. And other people see it as, you know, the real working class rockers that really rock out like none other. Why do we see this division in AC/DC?
Well, there is a video clip. Have you ever seen that video clip of them making fun of punk?
I have not.
You can see it on YouTube or something. It's some reporter asking them and they make fun of punk or belittle it a little bit. But I don't know if there's ever like a band that crosses over beside that bridges rockers and punkers, it's Motorhead and AC/DC.
Well, but I'm glad you're talking about the organicness, if that's a word. I don't think it is. The organicity. That is not the word. The organic style of AC/DC, because one of the things that I like about the new Western Addiction album is, I don't know if it was recorded to analog, but you guys recorded it with very little, I guess, producer sheen, and it's a fairly raw recording, correct?
Yeah, it was recorded to tape, and then it gets put into digital. So it does have that, but our producer, Jack Shirley, his philosophy is that a band should try to record live. And we were definitely against that because, I mean, we're not the best band, and he just said to us, he goes, have you ever played a show? We said, yes. And he goes, have you ever made it through a song? And we just said, yeah. And he's like, okay. Did things fall apart? We said, no. He goes, okay, can you try? And we tried, and it bizarrely worked. And you do get, I mean, we like our records to sound, I'll say hot and messy, but with big production. Does that make sense?
Yes, indeed.
I don't know why bands record, or if it sounds muffled or lo-fi. Like, I want it to sound big and produced and like a big rock and roll record, but it can be sloppy in performance and it can have tons of feedback and, you know, not be on time. That's all fine, but I just want to hear it, have it sound big.
What's your opinion on, I guess, for me, a bone of contention, and you might disagree, but like a lot of punk records, I think these days sound like too slick, too processed. Yeah. So I like a raw sound. I don't know if you have a perspective on that or not. Or
I do have a perspective on it, and so it's nothing against those bands. They can do it however they want, but it doesn't sound like a band. Like when you're standing up there and, you know, you can hear the monitors and you can feel the air of the kick drum on the back of your leg, and you can hear a little bit here on the right, a little bit here on the left. That's what a band sounds like. So when I hear those records, I'm like, this doesn't sound like a music. This sounds like nothing I hear on stage. So I want it to sound as much like we sound like in person. Why would you want this big polished thing and then we show up and we're just like a sloppy mess? You might as well get the real version of us, so you know what to expect.
Yeah, fair enough. One of the themes on the new record is like hope and perseverance and that kind of a thing. You know, a lot of people are kind of negative right now, and myself included. You know, with the COVID-19 closing everything down, with the current administration, a lot of people are kind of bummed out. But you used to be making the argument now is the time to stay positive.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is we never really time our records for these things. Like the last one, Tremulous, it was people asked if they were political songs. I'm like, no, but they really apply. And now this, it really applies. I mean, there's no way but to go forward. I mean, everybody gets bummed out. I get bummed out. But I can sit here and be bummed, or I can try, or I can, I mean, we put out a record during one of the worst times in the last 100 years. And I can be bummed about that, or I can be like, you know what, this just happened. What are we going to do? We're going to try again. You know, we're going to play when we can play in the future. But I don't know. I just, my grandpa kind of taught me to go forward, you know, just shrug your shoulders and go forward.
One thing, and I don't know if you have a perspective on this or not, on Facebook and on Instagram, we all have a friend or an acquaintance that's always like, you know, positivity is the way to life. You know, you should always be positive. Always look on the bright side. And my perspective, yeah. My perspective, like being like overly positive is almost a way of lying to yourself, because the world can be negative sometimes.
I totally agree. You know, when you see self-help people and they're like, you know, today's going to be a great day. That's lying. I don't do any of that, because you know that those people are going to split apart at the seams, or they're just hiding something just nefarious, like in their shed or something. It's just like a warning signal. I don't believe in any of that. I think I am kind of a depressed person that's just like, okay, let's just give this a shot. Because if I didn't give it a shot, if I didn't even give band things a shot, we would never go anywhere or do anything. I'm not like a person who needs applause or needs to be on stage, or I just wanted to try to make some music. And if I was like, if I didn't even try, we would have nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I hear you 100%. An interesting thing about you, I think you work in marketing, don't you?
Yeah, I work at a branding agency, and I name products and services and companies. Kind of a weird job.
There's an interesting thing about that is some people would say, you know, marketing and commercialism has nothing to do with punk at all, and it's anti the punk ethos. However, you know, if you look at Crass, or the Misfits, but Crass especially, particularly powerful marketers, Crass, with their symbolism, with their logos, with the repeated use of themes. I'm curious as to your opinion. Is marketing inherently evil? Is it inherently good? Or does it depend on how you bend it? You know what I mean?
It doesn't have to be. I mean, do you follow that environmental group called Extinction Rebellion?
No, I don't even know what that is.
So it's this environmental group, and I think they're based in the UK, but they do all these protests, and you might have seen any of the protests in your town. It's where everyone dresses up kind of like they have red cloaks on. They're called the Red Rebels. Anyways, what I'm trying to say is this is like a radical environmental group, but they have the best marketing. It's like one gigantic art project that's so good looking. It's so stylized. You can use these things for good. I kind of like even like looking at their imagery as much as I like their cause. But I mean, if you use things for the right reasons, yes, of course. But I try not to get into that stuff, because all punk fans get into their Ford Econoline vehicle and they pump Chevron gas into their car and they get on United Airlines, because you have to. If you want to be in a band, you have to do these things. Unless you get to a big level and you're like Pearl Jam and you can have some, you know, roller buses or something. But it's hard not to dabble in the system a little bit. So I try my best to not use it for bad reasons, but you have to participate a little bit to get the word out.
I agree with you. I think one thing that maybe people miss with marketing is that at its core, marketing can be very useful in that it identifies a source of origin with a product, you know. And if you had no marketing, you wouldn't know what product you're getting or where the source is coming from, which can be as dangerous as, I guess, malevolent marketing, if you will.
Yeah, it's hard nowadays to get traction. There's so much noise, and I feel like I'm bugging people all the time. But I don't go around saying our band is good, and I don't expect people to think it's good. I just want them to give it a try. I'm like, just give it a listen. If you don't like it, that's totally fine too. I mean, me screaming all the time isn't for everyone. But I do have to, you feel guilty all the time because you're doing this perpetual push on something, especially right now too with COVID-19. It feels terrible to talk about yourself when people are passing, so it's just the weirdest time. So you can use it for the right reasons or the wrong reasons. I just try to balance it somehow.
Here's an interesting thing. Rarely in rock music do we hear themes of motherhood. We do once in a while now, and kind of in the 70s, but rarely do we hear concepts of motherhood come from male singers. Yet you have two songs, at least, focusing on motherhood on the new record. Why is that?
Well, Danzig beat me to it. He talked.
That's true.
Well, my wife is a certified doula, and so you know what that is. It's like a midwife. It's someone that assists in when you're having a baby. And she, in the same way, we're into rock and roll and, you know, obscure topics. She's into motherhood, and I've kind of been in the background. I kind of hear all these things, and I watch, and she tells me stuff, and it blows my mind about how misunderstood and it's not respected, and it's like one of the most powerful things that can happen on earth. And so I just started kind of listening to it. I'm like, man, there's some real power in this. And then one of my daughters was doing this report about, you know, powerful female figures throughout history, and she was talking about the ancient Egyptians where they were worshiping women, and you think of Cleopatra, and it's like the symbols were almost like asexual or like genderless, and it was kind of cool, but it took the form of a woman. And I don't know, it's like it's easy to, you know, do harm, but it's hard to raise a life. And I mean, think of the power of bringing life into the world. If you really think about it, it's pretty powerful. So I thought it deserved a song.
What was there any challenge as writing about that as a male? You know what I mean? Like a classic example is here's a classic example, like guys like the Grateful Dead. You know, the Grateful Dead were some rich guys from Palo Alto, and they're masquerading as these yokels from, you know, Kentucky. You know, and so if you look at that from a certain perspective, you're like, that's kind of poor form because it's kind of rude to, you know, people from central, the center of the country. That being said, was there any challenge to writing from that? Like did you have to, I guess, the question is, did you have to carefully think it through, or did you just speak from your heart and it came out okay? You see what I'm saying?
I try to always kind of keep those things in my mind,
yeah,
about whether I'm respecting all groups. I don't ever say I'm a feminist because I don't know. It's not my place, but I live with all women. I have daughters and my wife's a pretty strong lady. So I didn't grow up. I grew up in a small town where thinking back on all those things that are said about women is wrong. And then when I moved to San Francisco, my whole entire world flipped around where you just see all these different kinds of people and you respect them in different ways. So yes, you could say that I'm not an expert and I'll never be an expert on what it's like to be a woman or to have a child, but I am a dad and I have watched this go down a little bit and I have kind of seen some of these movies and these things my wife has showed me. So I don't know. I try to make it a tribute versus me telling people or a lesson, you know what I mean? It's almost like a tribute to motherhood.
Well, I think that's a very great perspective to have because, I mean, if you look at the history of, you know, like Motley Crue, like you see not the victimization, what do you call it, the objectification of women. So it's interesting. And we rarely, even today, we rarely see this from a male perspective, the opposite of objectification. You know what I mean? So that's pretty interesting. One last thing I want to talk about. Simon and Garfunkel, they get kind of a shout out on the last track.
Yes, I love them.
Okay.
Oh, so sorry. Yeah, they did. I like them anyways, and I'm always thinking about them. And I think Paul Simon's like one of the best songwriters of all time. And it was, I get into like these deep areas of things. And right when I was writing that song, I was really into Simon and Garfunkel, and I was really into black metal at the same time. So I'm kind of melding those two topics. Usually I like take universal themes, and the universal theme of that song was, do you know that song called the only living boy in New York?
Yes.
Well, it's about when Garfunkel actually got offered to be in a movie and he left during the recording of, I think it was Bridge Over Troubled Water. And Paul Simon was like, dude, what the hell are you doing? We're in a band. Why are you going away and doing this movie? It's pissing me off. And so he was really upset. And then, the other part, so it's just about people being upset. And then I was listening to all this black metal, and I don't know if you want, have you ever watched Until the Light Takes Us?
It's about, yes, I have.
A story about mayhem. Okay. So what if you're a black metal guy and you just wanted to be happy, like it just seems so out of character. And I kind of just melded those things together. I love watching that movie. And I love that other one, Once Upon a Time in Norway. It's just so fascinating about how things can get so out of hand that you're, you know, burning churches and you know, passing out part of your friend's brain. And it's insane, right?
Actually, I'm glad, not to drag this out, and this isn't really apropos of anything, but I'm glad you bring that up. One of the, we've talked about him on the podcast before, Count Brishnak. What's his name?
Yeah.
His real name? I forget his real name.
Varg?
Yeah, Varg Vikernes is... Yeah. He's a bad guy. He's not a nice person. He's bad. But he's fascinating in that in black metal and hardcore, you see all these guys like, I'm tough. I'm a tough guy. Don't mess with us. I'm tough. And then you watch like videos of Varg, who was a literal killer and who has literally burnt down at least 3 or 4 churches, maybe more. He's like dancing around and laughing and joking and hanging out with his daughter in these videos. And so I'm fascinated and creeped out by his actual killer, who has none of these attribute that we see with hardcore metal bands, whereas I'm tough. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I mean, that's why I do like hardcore, because I think it's like the most real form of music. I mean, I like metal too, but we were talking about this in the band. If you worship death and you were into death metal and black metal, wouldn't this be just the glory time for you? I just think those things get, some of it is like theatrical, and that's fine. Have you ever, you know that band, they're called Mount Fury?
Is Phil Ephraim? Is that one of his bands?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he used to be super into black metal. And then when his wife passed away, he was like, you know what? Why are all these people worshiping death? They have no idea what this means. And like you think it's kind of like a joke, and you're like, you're playing around with death. And he's like, man, if they knew what I went through, they wouldn't be talking about this stuff. But he goes, when we had my wife's funeral, in the church, I played that band. They're called Zather, you know, like Z-A-T-S-T-H-U-R, where it's really aggressive black metal. And he said he turned it up so loud. He goes, it was the only appropriate time for me to listen to black metal again. It was just so depressing and powerful that I turned it up in the church. And I'm like, that is wild. That, you know what I mean? So you're right. It's like people like, are you really into death? Because when, you know, when a virus comes for you, that doesn't seem too funny to me.
Well, listen, Western Addiction and Jason Hall, Keeping It Positive, which is one of the themes of the new album. Jason, you want to hang around for the news?
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you so much.
All right, well, listen, let's play a tune. What tune should we send him out with regard to the interview section? What should we hit him with? Western Addiction or any other track? Which should we play?
Why don't we try that last song that we just talked about, Deranged by Grief?
All right, there we go. Let's listen to our black metal and Simon and Garfunkel shout-outs.
Yeah,
by West. It's
pretty normal.
And we'll be right back. And that was Western Addiction, that we are here with Jason Hall. All right, let's hit the news. We've got a fair amount of news this week. Let's see. Oh, this is big news. Speaking of positivity, this is big news. Jesse Michaels, we talked about it last week. He says he's going to release some new music with two guys, not the Hard Girls, a different band. It's a three-piece. He's playing guitar, I believe, somewhat surprisingly. And he's singing, and he says it's basically going to be hardcore. And he had a pretty funny statement. I don't know if we had that in our article or not, but his statement was say I'm pulling up right now. The point being is we were probably going to get Jesse Michaels' music much sooner than we thought we were going to get. He says he's going to release it within 2 weeks, which now would be in 1 week. Here's what he said. This is not directly topical to current events. The music will be influenced 80s-style hardcore with the usual complaining and socio-political agony in the lyrics. Not sure if it will be good or not, but if it's not, that is not the fault of Sharif Dumani or Peter John Fontes, which are the other two people in his band. Adam White, I am so psyched for this. I love Jesse's self-digging. I mean, I don't want to get my hopes up too high, just because Classics of Love was freaking amazing, but I'm very excited, and Adam, Jesse's never let me down.
I mean, it's nice that he's almost taking a bit of the expectation out of this, and that might make it a little bit more of a free project. So, like, if they are sitting down and recording quickly and they're going to turn around and put it out digitally, that's the kind of stuff that I think everyone needs to get them through this period without going crazy, is that there's been a ton of artists that are just, you know, preserving their own sanity, but also just putting something out for fans by making these, like, either bedroom recorded full lengths or, you know, stuff that they're assembling over remote distances with their band members. And it's, of course, not the ideal creative solution for someone given the alternative, but it's something. And the idea that Jesse's going to, you know, feel free just to go, you know, bang something out in a few weeks and put it out it feels within the spirit of the time, right? Like, you can worry too much about perfecting these things or taking them out into the, keeping them in the oven for too much time, you know, having some Jesse Michaels material all of a sudden show up, I think will make a lot of people happy. I mean, that's going to reflect on one of the stories that we're talking about in a minute too, because that'll play into that one. And you know what, John, it might just free up Jesse to do this a little bit more frequently than he does then. I mean, I'm worried sometimes, like, how much expectations does this guy have to live with when it comes to music? That is it a little bit paralyzing perhaps
are you ready to have your mind blown? You would think Jesse Michaels would be like, you know, I'm the Don, I'm Jesse Michaels, Operation Ivy, Common Rider, Classics of Love. I don't have to prove anything to anybody, you know? To the contrary, he's extremely self-conscious and worried about what other people think of him and his music. Isn't that fascinating?
I mean, that feels very...
Michael-ish?
Well, you would assume that an artist like him who has put out stuff sort of so infrequently, but clearly still has the interest in it, is probably someone that has those kinds of doubts and stuff to grapple with. I want Jesse to feel free to just, you know, put out stuff that he doesn't think is perfect, because the rest of us will probably still dig it.
I think that's honestly, I think that perhaps the criticism of classic, I'm not classic of love, of Common Rider. I like Common Rider a lot, but maybe it was a little too crisp. You know, where Classic of Love is a little bit rawer, and I think Classic of Love is his best thing he ever did. M, what's your stance on Jesse Michaels? Do you want Jesse to worry about being perfect, or do you just want him to spit it out?
Just spit it out. Because I think that's when, like, the best music happens, is when, you know, like, you have an idea and everything, but it's just, like, very, like, natural and organic, you know? And then, again, like, you don't have so much time to think about it and overthink it, and then, you know, not put it out or change it so much it's like something completely different. So I'm really excited for it, and I really like his voice and his whole like thing, so I'm excited. I think they'll be really good.
Jason, as an artist who has put out things somewhat sporadically, particularly between your first and second album, do you feel the pain that Jesse Michaels may feel as the expectations and people, I guess, analyzing every single step that you take?
I mean, no, because he's iconic, and we're just I mean, no one's expecting anything from us, but I'm down to hear it too. I'll listen to anything he makes, and I also think he has a fantastic voice. So I'm excited too.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely excited for this. Everything Jesse's done has been like at least very good to amazing. So I think what Jesse needs at this time is our positive support, and we all need to let Jesse know that we all love him. And I think that prompt is greatest star, you know. But Jason, let's talk about a contemporary of yours and a label mate, Bad Cop, Bad Cop. They got a new album coming out. They put out a track called Pursuit of Liberty. Jason, what's your stance on Bad Cop, Bad Cop?
I know Stacey from when she was in Angry Amputees, and she is such a nice person. Her voice is so good. Her voice and Brenna from The Last Gang. Brenna sang on our record a little bit. I don't know. I can't sing very well, and so I'm always enamored of people that can. and Stacey can really sing, and she can sing melody, and she's just always so pleasant every time I talk to her. And when we played our first show back, getting back together, in I think 2013, they were playing across the street, and she came over and said, "Hey, we're your label mates," you know, and said hello again. And she's just such a pleasant person that I always enjoy seeing her and hearing whatever she's going to try.
Bad Cop, Bad Cop, what are you feeling these days?
I like this song a lot better than their first single that I think we talked about like a few podcasts ago. Because I really like the band, and I will listen to whatever they put out. And I like this direction. I like how it tells like such a story, and like the lyrical content is really, really good. I had to look up the lyrics, and I was like doing like a deep dive because there were things I didn't know what they were. And then I was like looking at different things, and it was really, really interesting that way. And it's been going through my head all day. And I think I listened to it like twice this morning, and like it hasn't stopped, and I've listened to other music. So that's always a good sign.
Adam White, this is right up your alley. The Dropkick Murphys are playing a show in Fenway Park, and Bruce Springsteen is going to be there. The Working Man's Musician, that only charges $750 a ticket on Broadway. And they're playing to themselves. There's not going to be anybody in Fenway Park, so it's going to be a grand spectacle. Adam, is this what the community needs to come together in this tough time? A Dropkick Murphys show where Bruce Springsteen is going to show up and play Ship It Up to Boston with them? Or is this self-aggrandizement and Dropkick Murphys appointing themselves as the speakers of the Northeastern United States when maybe they haven't earned that station?
Oh, see, I'm going to flip this on you and not take your negativity bait, John, because here's what we're all coping with being stuck in isolation in our own little ways here. And one of the strange things that has come about in my life is I am unironically rocking a lot of these like Hellcat Records, Dropkick Murphys albums, like the Sing Loud, Sing Proud era of stuff. And I don't know why. Like, there's a lot of that music that I was like really into when I was younger. And then I moved on into, I guess, more. This sounds reductive, but you know, like more adventurous musical territory and stuff like that. As I got older and started getting into other things, and I haven't paid a whole ton of attention to a band like Dropkick Murphys in a long time. But holy shit, have I not been sitting around like, you know, going stir crazy with the kids in the house, and have just like been like, we're listening to the Dropkick Murphys and put it on, and it's happened like. Four times in the past 2 weeks, and I'm not even sure why. I'm not sure what's motivating it, but each time I'm having a fucking ball. So, isolation brain Adam is kind of into this. I feel that the Springsteen aspect of this might be a little bit overblown. I've been seeing it kind of like headlined in a lot of the news as you know, Dropkick Murphys and Bruce Springsteen are playing this thing. And even if you read the text on their Instagram posts, I don't think that's exactly what's going on. I think that like the band is going to be there doing their live stream, And at some point they're going to, you know, from they're going to simulcast, you know, the boss in from wherever the fuck he's holed up, and they'll do something. But I don't know. I can just picture like them rocking away and doing their lovably goofy thing, and then all of a sudden like all the air comes out of it because they're trying to coordinate the Zoom call that Springsteen's on into it. And if there's one thing that I think like that this whole thing has taught us is that it's painful to watch artists squirm as the shitty streaming tech that was not made for live music broadcast starts to break down on them in real time. I've seen it a few times now where I've tuned into this or that artist that's trying to do something fun, and they end up basically like running around in front of the camera, pulling their hair out for 10 minutes as they try to figure out like why the audio isn't showing up on Instagram or whatever, or they're dealing with all the feedback from people and half of it's wrong. I watched one the other day where it was actually a pretty good performance. The audio sounded great. Everything was fine. And then all of a sudden midway through, and this was like a Facebook stream, the performer stopped and he said, "Oh, I'm told that you can't get the audio on Facebook." And everyone's commenting is like, "What? No, stop. Like, what are you talking about? We're all listening." And then he like killed the stream and created another one. And then like 3/4 of the audience vanished because of this. And it's just like, ugh, like this is.
Who's that?
It was B.A. Johnson, actually. But it was like, I've seen him suffer like twice doing this, where like he tried to do this performance where the whole gimmick was like, you know, playing from an abandoned bar, and he went back to like the big rock and roll bar in Hamilton, Ontario, and got up on stage there, and they had it all set up where there was going to be like 3 or 4 cameras that were shooting it and all this, and you know, really high effort and tons of pre-promotion went into it. All these tiny bars and clubs that were getting shuttered around the country were like sharing the stream on their own you know, Facebook pages and Instagram accounts and stuff like that. It's supposed to be like a big community effort to help all these venues. But whenever he switched to like camera 3, there was no more audio. And there was just like stuff like that where you could just see him, like he knew it was fucking up, but he was also on camera at the time. And, you know, he's not sitting there with a crew. So there was just a lot of that, a lot of pain. So yeah, I don't have high hopes for the Bruce Springsteen thing. I mean, that said, maybe the Murphys can afford better production values than, like, you know, weirdos that I watch. But yeah, I mean, just, Adam, I'm into this for some reason.
How come the Dropkick Murphys don't have the social distance? I do they all live together, so it doesn't count?
Yeah, they live in one house, man.
Well, listen, Jason Hall, you find yourself in a quagmire. The Punk News Podcast is trying to drag you into a diss battle with Dropkick Murphys and the Boss, which could potentially be harmful for your future prospect. What do you
do? I do not mess with either.
Do you take the battle head on? Do you do a political, you know, sidestep? I will say Dropkick Murphy's also a CC fan.
I do not mess with the Boss or the Dropkick. But I do. So this is going to be them all playing together, but live, right? They're on a stage, right?
Presume that they're claiming that they're going to, the claim is that Dropkick Murphys are going to be at Fenway Park on stage, and the Boss is going to come in on the video.
They're claiming they're going to be in the infield.
I mean, personally, I do not like any of these quarantine videos. I think they're so awkward. I think the only people that have done a good job is Rhett Miller from the old 97s and Ben Gibbard from Death Cab for Cutie. A lot of them are just not real. Did you see the one where the Rolling Stones were playing, where Charlie Watts was just sort of air drumming, but there was a drum beat? Like, I'm like, just at least try to fool us, you know?
I disagree. I thought that was awesome because Charlie Watts, Muppet Ringo Starr, is quite famously the most cantankerous Stone, and seems to not be in the Rolling Stones, even though he's been in the band for like 60 years. So I think that's him being like, yes, I'm the baddest drummer in rock and roll, and I don't care. You know what I mean?
That's maybe he has earned it. That's fine. So I'm interested to see this. Actually, I love Bruce Springsteen too. But do any of you guys watch soccer, European football at all? Because this weekend they showed the first game back. It's the German league, you know, it's the Bundesliga or whatever. and they did no crowd. And it was so trippy because you can't feel any intensity of the moment. And so I'm wondering if like the Dropkick, no crowd, will that be kind of strange for a band? I mean, maybe it's like band practice. I don't know.
That is a good point, because Dropkick Murphys is particularly a crowd interactive band. You know, I saw them open for Misfits, and like, you know, every other song, they're like, yeah, let's hear it for the crowd, or what, they would get the crowd very involved in the show, you know? So
yeah, maybe they should feel what it's like to play to no one, just like the rest of us.
I feel like the one way that they can make this work, and maybe they can make it work given the setting, is if they do something interesting with the way this thing is shot, then it might be kind of fun. Like I could picture some fantasy version of this where, you know, the band is they're on the diamond, they are, you know, distanced away from each other or whatever, right? They're doing their thing, but it's not one or two static cameras that's doing it. It's got a little bit more movement in what they're trying to shoot, and that might kind of account for the crowd not being there in the same way that you would have, say, like a music video of a band playing in their practice space or something like that, right? And all of a sudden you get the, you know, you get the headstock of the bass in your face or something like that, right? Where things are moving around. And I'm wondering how they could do that. And I think that the revelation I saw today is that everyone today is going on about this vanity. Have you seen this? There was a Vanity Fair photo shoot with Catherine O'Hara from Schitt's Creek. And they did this big professional photo shoot with her, but they did it while maintaining all the distancing because they did it with drones. So So she, you know, they did this whole shoot, and there's one or two behind the scenes things in it. And the behind the scenes, you know, there was someone basically sitting on the other side of her yard flying a drone around that was actually taking the pictures of her. So I could totally see there being some, you know, Dropkick Murphys in Fenway Park. There's drones flying around. They're crashing. They're getting into all sorts of situations. This is what I want. I want the kaleidoscopic drone cam version of this. What I don't want is some jackass sitting there with an iPhone in a lawn chair, like 20 feet away, trying to stream it on Instagram. Cause that sounds horrible.
Well, speaking of a man that has mastered technology, and this guy really was on the forefront of digital music, Jeff Rosenstock, just yesterday, he released a surprise new album. The surprise new album is called No Dream, and it's the Jeff Rosenstock Band's fourth album. It was released with absolutely no forecast whatsoever. I think he did it with his last album, too. Of course, Run the Jewels has also followed somewhat of a similar strategy. M. Moore, did you check out the track? Are you a Rosenstock fan? And also, do you think the surprise sudden album drop in 2020, is that a statement that gets people's attention? Or do you think maybe that like you drop it, everyone talks about it for a day, and then everyone forgets about it because there was no lead up to it? I think nobody knows, but maybe you have a perspective.
Well, I'll just start off with the surprise release. I think especially now, it kind of makes like, oh, today something could drop, today could be exciting, you know, something could happen today and kind of break up the monotony of kind of the like quarantine routines and stuff. So I'm all for the surprise releases, like especially now. Before now, like it was kind of like, you know, really easy to overlook and like not even know that they came out. But now I think there's more of a like it'll stick more in people's minds because they'll be like, oh, like that was kind of a, like a shitty time. And, you know, Jeff Rosenstock released something and it was like really, really good. And we weren't expecting it. And it really brightened our day. So I think that in this era, surprise releases are almost like the way to go in one way. But like there's stuff to be said for having like a concrete release date and then leading up to it and having like the singles and the videos and everything and then like building the anticipation and the excitement and releasing it and having a big like celebration about that. I think that's really important and not to lose sight of that in one way. I like Jeff Rosenstock. I hadn't heard of him until I think it was like 2015 and I saw him open for Pup. and he was amazing live. And then I went back and listened, like to, I think it was, the We Cool album. And that was just like really good. So I've been following him since then. And with No Dream yesterday, I listened to it twice. Today, I listened to it once. I like it. It's good. Happy stuff.
Jason Hall, you famously worked at you worked at Fat Records for a while, right?
I did for 11 years.
So as a guy that got started during the tail end of the classic period of music, that is where there was firm release dates, you know, we've got this much time to work up, but we want to let people know about it. What's your perspective of the free digital giveaway, Jeff Rosenstock style, and also the sudden surprise, here's the album, out of the blue stand?
I feel bad going against what Em said, but I'm very against this on several different. I thought a lot about this, and I'm not a person that's like the old ways better. I'm never for that. Actually, our record cover doesn't have our band name or our album title on the cover, and I had to fight like tooth and nail to get that to happen. And that's me pushing back against the old way. So I think this method goes against like the basic core of how humans want to take things in. I think humans want the chase. You want it with everything, with dating, with eating dinner. You always want this thing that you just can't quite have. So if you think about it in terms of like, so Game of Thrones, right, is every Sunday. I marched my ass into my bedroom like and watched it every Sunday because I'm like, oh, when I could watch it whenever, but I did it. And then have you guys watched that show called Fleabag?
No.
It's Phoebe Waller-Bridge. It only was on two seasons for Netflix, but it was so good, but they released it all at once. And the same way with Aziz Ansari's show, where it's like once. So if your show's good, it's just going to go away. If it's bad, it's going to go away even quicker. You need to give people like something to first understand and then go, oh, I want to hear a little bit more of that. So that's one point. The other point is like, as a person who makes records, sometimes you're working on a record, it's like painting a picture for 3 years. And you're like, hey, you guys, I've been painting this picture for 3 years. Here it is. And they're like, that's pretty cool. Anyway, like on to the next thing. It's like heartbreaking that what you care about is just like, yep, I just ate that. Now it's gone. But I did check out Jeff Rosenstock's record, and he recorded with Jack Shirley too. That's who our producer was at Atomic Garden. So I'm always interested in hearing what he has to put out. But I do not like these releases. At least give me one single. And if your record is not really good, I think it's like a death sentence.
Well said. One thing that Adam and I have talked about in the past is that we were Adam, you were a Big Bomb Music Industry guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we were both Big Bomb Music Industry guys, and I think we were both like big Scrambles fans. And then where Adam and I somewhat fell off was Vacation, in that Rosenstock kind of stepped away from the wild, wacky, crazy stuff and kind of got into the more sad millennial thing, which I respected it as art, and I think it was well done, but it wasn't for me. That being said, this new album I feel like is almost built out of the last Bomb Music Industry EP that never happened, which was supposed to be a hardcore EP. And not that this album is hardcore, but we've got a lot of faster songs here. Not quite as crazy as Scrambles, but I am digging this, although I do have mixed feelings about Rose. I like Rose, I like the band, but I have mixed Rose feelings about what the band means to me. And so, Adam, I'm going to ask your opinion about this, and then I'm going to use Jason as my counselor. But go ahead, Adam, what do you think of it?
I haven't burned through too much of it yet. I'm a fan of the smattering of aggression that he's throwing in from sort of track to track here. There's what is it? The third song on this thing is called Hold on, I had it in front of me a second ago. It was like Scram, where all of a sudden there's this like pretty unexpected breakdown in the middle of it. I like Jeff being spontaneous and wacky, and I think that's where he works for me a little bit more. I think what John is referring to with regards to where him and I sort of fell off was Jeff has, I think, has this like enviable position where he has, I don't know if like by design or just because the fact that he's really good about it, really good at his craft here, is that he's created a little bit of this like voice of a generation mystique amongst a certain amount of people. And I think validly so, given some of the anxieties that he tends to voice in his music. But it's just that when I tune into them, they're not anxieties that I have any direct relation with at this point. Like as a late 30s male with like kids in a house and a stable job and stuff like that, like I don't have to worry about the price of rent in New York City or whatever, right? So whereas a lot of the things that he'll touch on and I think are like, you know, are very real things that I think people younger than me have to grapple with. I just don't. So he's someone that I think I'm following more from a musical standpoint and less so from a, I don't know, from like a hero worship standpoint at this point in the game. But I don't know, John, was that what you were asking? Like where I land on that? I mean, musically, right. This one is cool. Right, I like this. I like this record so far. I like what I've heard of it. But yeah, that's where like me and Jeff sit.
So Jason, I'm going to give you a somewhat heavy question, and I'm glad you're here because you were in a band. You've been in, well, you've been in a couple bands. You've been in Wet Addiction for a while. You have some very hardcore fans. And so tell me your perspective as a performer. So back in the day, punk music and bond music industry were very buddy-buddy. We would email them and talk to them. They'd come on the show, and we had a lot of fun. And then after a little while, basically kind of when bond music industry morphed into the Jeff Rosenstock band, that connection went away. And at that time, Jeff Rosenstock band got more notice from indie circles and kind of grew out of the punk scene. And I'm not chastising the band for going out of the punk scene or whatever. I think it's definitely cool to get bigger and go beyond what you used, you know, the thing that you used to do. I think it's very cool. But where we sort of felt left out is they seemed to leave us behind. And that is, whereas we used to be buddy buddies with these guys, we never heard from them anymore. And part of that was because at the time, the publicist they had actually was very anti-punk news. So she wouldn't have any of her bands at punk news, which annoyed me a great deal. That's not the band's fault, mind you know. And actually, I can't even blame them for that because you got to make money, you know. And so from a career standpoint, maybe that was the smart move to do. You know what I mean? And so for a while, I felt kind of weird about the band. But on one hand, it's like, well, I mean, they're not your best friend. They're not there to, you know, to make you feel good about yourself. You know what I mean? So were we valid in having those feelings, you know, or were we being too clingy? You know, and the reason I bring this up is because I'm like, you know, this album is cool. I might get back into the Jeff Rosenstock band and become a big fan. And what annoyed me, and this is probably psycho of me. So they were retweeting any news organization that was mentioning it. They were retweeting. We were one of the first people to mention this. We didn't get a retweet, which bugged me a little bit. But I think I think I might be psycho. Jason, am I psycho? Should I go commit myself?
No, you create these emotional connections with fans, and when they go on and up, and then they don't, you know, interact with you, that would hurt anyone's feelings. I mean, I can see them trying to like do something new. We have this problem a little bit too, where we play with the pop punk bands because we're on Fat, but we don't sound like them. And then when we try to go, like, none of the metal bands or the hardcore bands will even, you know, give us the time of day. But once we play with them, they're like, okay, you guys are okay, you can stay. But it's like this barrier to getting into other areas. But so I am thankful for the pop punk people, but I would like it to open up. But I don't think I could ever forget it. I also am a person, like, I sit in the merch booth. There's all these things you do in bands too, where you're like, you can't be in the merch booth, that's not cool. I'm like, I don't know, man. People are so excited, especially little kids too. And I have kids, so I know what it feels like. I know what it felt like when I would shake the hand of a band person when I was younger. It's like, this is insane. This is so cool. So I do talk to kids, and they're even they're so excited to talk to me, which is insane. I can kind of see them too, like hanging off to the side. I'm like, dude, just come up and talk. You should be excited for, you know, Greg Graffin, not me, dude. Just come over here. But I think it is good to like reach out and just show respect to people. It doesn't kill you. You're at a show to have a conversation with people, and they're seriously so excited to meet you. It's so flattering.
Well, there you have Jason Hall, the voice of reason, as always. Jason Hall, thank you for coming on the Punk News Podcast. You were eloquent, insightful, and a lot of fun to hang out with. So listen, man, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you guys so much. Thanks for checking out our record. I really appreciate it. This was fun.
Cheers, Jason. Well, nice talking to you. That was Jason Hall from Western Addiction. And Jason, we'll talk again soon-ish.
Take care.
Later. And that was Jason Hall from Western Addiction. Let's play, who's got a song to play? I'll play a song then.
Oh.
If none of these...
You can actually play a song here. I will have one for later.
Okay. The song that I was just
fucking with you because you left some awkward silence there.
the song that I will play is a good song. I will play a song by... Oh, I know what I'm going to play. Listen, have I played Clear Channel yet? Maybe I have. All right, tell you what. Let's play some Joe Jack Packham, because Joe Jack Packham's the man. Here's a rare track. About 4 or 5 months ago, Joe Jack Packham showed up at the Daniel Johnston documentary screening in Philadelphia, and he played 5 Daniel Johnston covers. And he released them on his website for free as part of his bootleg of the month. So let's listen to Joe Jack Packham covering Daniel Johnston, Big Monkey Business, which is one of my favorite Daniel Johnston songs and one of my favorite Joe Jack Packham covering Daniel Johnston songs. This is Joe Jack Packham on an unreleased recording covering Daniel Johnston's Big Monkey Business. And we'll be right back.
This one is also from one of these tapes that is floating around. This one's called Big Business Monkey. Big Business Monkey, nothing's funny. Big Business Monkey, everything's money. He'll sell you a cheeseburger with a cashier smile. He runs his house like the Burger King manager. And the only jokes he knows are the ones that'll put you down. Take over the world, and you can have it now, but you can't take it with you. And everything you cling to will rot, and everything you do will be forgot by everyone you
Oh, go ahead. What's that?
I was going to say, so we have a few more stories that we're going to talk about this week. Although I feel that you purposely stuck the negative stuff in the latter half of the show so Jay Jason wouldn't have to be inflicted by
negative stuff. I think three of these things are positive.
Well, the things that maybe negative is not the right word, but I think things that dredge up past contentions. But we'll see.
I still feel bad about Rosenstock. I think I'm in the wrong here. I think my feelings aren't valid. That's the negative.
Well, I mean, the fact that these feelings in particular were dredged up today because of Twitter, of all things, is maybe a sign that you need to let go of your
I think emotions. I just need to walk. I don't know why it's sticking with me. I mean, usually I don't care that much about band. You know, I don't know why it's sticking with me. I guess because we were kind of palsy-wowsy. You know what I mean?
John, I'm sure he's flattered that you think so much about him. All right, so let's talk about this. Let's talk about this first story here. So we've been, and actually, John, I'm curious if my feelings are valid here, or if we need to talk about the 800 pound gorilla, because this is the second or third time that we are going to have talked about the fate of the Live Nation organization during the time of COVID. But what I'm getting bombarded with is pleas from all of these small venues that are trying to survive and small bookers and small organizations that are you know looking to keep it together. Are we wrong for giving any time of day to Live Nation when everyone else is you know probably way more fucked up, or are we bringing up these Live Nation stories?
Absolutely not. It is not our job to determine what people should or should not hear. That is, it is our job to report the news. It is not our job to make news. So I would agree, perhaps, that maybe we could do a better job at posting not this little venue needs money, that little venue, a broad article, and that little venues need money. Let's help them out. We could do a better job at that. But it is not our job, nor should it be, for us to not report bad news. Or good news, you know what I mean? I mean, honestly, Adam, I would say by reporting on Live Nation, we're kind of performing a civic duty in favor of small venues. You know, I think people don't realize how oppressive, or maybe they do, but how oppressive and basically how sinister Live Nation is.
Well, let's read this story, and then we'll circle back to this, because I just realized that you and I are talking about a story that we haven't actually said.
Well, listen. Live Nation, here's the story. So Live Nation recently got an $800 million, not a loan from the federal government. Basically, the federal government bought $800 million of debt from Live Nation, and they're going to use it for general corporate purposes, which is vague. Then literally, like 4 days after that happened, Live Nation said, oh, we're going to lay off 20% of our employees, or furlough off 20% of our employees. And it just goes to show how corrupt and how wrong many aspects of the current system are, because A, why are we subsidizing Ticketmaster? I mean, of all the essential businesses and small businesses and people not making ends meet, do we need to subsidize Ticketmaster? No, look, the CEO of Ticketmaster does not need a $10 million bonus this year. We can take that $10 million and give it to small venues. It'll help them out a lot more. You know, second of all, the government is loaning money to Live Nation so they can pay their employees. I mean, that's the point of it. And they respond by laying off 20% of their employees. You know what I mean? So, and they're not suffering for it at all. To the contrary, they're doing really, really, really well despite of it. And further, Live Nation and Ticketmaster, you know, like the service fees are literally 40% of it. You buy a $20 ticket, the service fee is $12, which is obscene, right? So they're charging obscene prices on top of the price of the ticket. Why can they not withstand a 6-week recession? Like, you'd think they could withstand 6 weeks, because they're making that just goes to show how much money they funnel out of the company and into the executives and shareholders, and just how messed up this whole system is. It's highlighting how screwed up a lot of this stuff is, and how it's only getting worse, I'm afraid to say. I'd like to be positive, but I can't. The point, to answer your question, Adam, is we should be reporting this so people know how messed up the system is, so they can vote with their dollar. Will they? I don't think.
Right. Yes. So I don't think I disagree with you in there. I mean, I guess what I'm struggling with from my own conscience here is it's like I woke up the yesterday and there was a bunch of text messages that were on my phone from someone that that books shows out in Vancouver and Calgary and Edmonton, and they're like, can you post an article on Punk News that has that supports this petition where was it here? Where it's a petition where they're trying to get the Canadian government to allow for-profit venues and businesses to be included in the emergency support fund for culture and heritage that's been created, because right now they're not allowed into that. They're not allowed into that pool of money and support benefits because specifically they're a for-profit business and yada, yada, yada. And I totally feel for it, because what he's saying in this thing that I got is, you know, we're trying to support, you know, the guy that's running the local bar in town that plays shows. And on the one hand, yeah, like that's the person that needs funding, not the Live Nations of the world. On the other hand, I'm looking at that and going, like, how many petitions and calls for helps and GoFundMes and stuff like that from every corner of the music universe would we all of a sudden open ourselves up to by posting one of them, right? It's the reason why we don't post those kinds of fundraiser things in the first place, is because like when does it stop? When then all of a sudden it's our that then we're judging which causes are worthy of Punk News article and which causes are not, and it's a sticky thing for us to have to do as a publication. But
what if it turns out it's like a secret Nazi group behind it, and then people say Punk News supports Nazis? You know what I mean?
That's not my worry, but sure, right? But I've just been thinking about it because it's been knocking around my brain, thinking like, what do we do? And I guess maybe it isn't Punk News' role to do anything in this, but it's just I'm so freaked out about what's going to happen to the live music world through there. So is there anything else to say about this other than that, like, Live Nation sucks? Or
well, the point is, the broader issue is that how, and this is just Live Nation, think of all the other companies that are benefiting from these schemes, or one hand washing the other, you know, medicine, transportation, you name it. So many things are benefiting from this. And meanwhile, the small guys, like, all these programs are pitched at helping the small guy survive, when it's clear the vast majority of the funds are going to people that are already rich, that don't even need the money, that are probably ripping you off to begin with. And I wish I had a better forecast instead of doom and gloom, but that's all I can say. And more, can you see a positive spin to this?
The only positive spin is, I think something that you said a bit earlier about the story is people vote with their dollars, and just all the stuff that's coming out about Live Nation and Ticketmaster, like, maybe people will actually like see the scope of it and just the like grossness and the just corporate, just, yeah, you know, like, they don't care about anybody. They don't care about the bands. They don't care about the venues. You know, again, it's just they want more money for themselves. So hopefully this like sparks a backlash against Ticketmaster, sparks a backlash against Live Nation, and more people support local venues and smaller venues. And again, just go with their gut.
And why are we bailing out Ticketmaster of all people? Like, why? Anyways. Adam White said this was a negative article, and I'm trying to figure out why. Maybe he thinks it's crass. Anyways, crass in the concept of ungainly, not crass in the concept of the band. Peter Hook is releasing a DVD of his So This Is Permanent show. The show was, I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago, where he did the entire Joy Division discography from the first to the last song, roughly in order that they were recorded, in order that they were released. With his band, The Light. So it's Peter Hook, the bass player from Joy Division and New Order, doing every single Joy Division track ever with his band in a row. It's about 3 hours long. He's also re-releasing the 3-CD version. He's re-releasing a whole bunch of other stuff. I've seen, I think, 5 of the Peter Hook shows. He did all Joy Division. He did then the first 2 New Order albums, and the 3rd and 4th New Order album, and the 5th and 6th New Order album. And, well, I'm not going to say what I thought, but Adam, why did you think it was a negative story? Did you think this was just kind of like exploitation?
No. I just meant that in general, we were going to talk about Live Nation on this half of the show, and that my brain was going to turn to complete putty, and that is exactly what happened. So I have no opinion about this one way or another. It sounds like a lovely artifact. You should go buy some.
Here's my opinion. I've seen Peter Hook live, and he really does punk up the songs, especially like the later day New Order stuff. And people say, well, actually, when it first happened, people were like, oh, it's not Joy Division, it's not New Order. Well, he's not saying it is. He's saying it's Peter Hook. And he's got as much right to play the songs as anybody else. He wrote them, or he wrote parts of them. And I just think it's that. I've seen him live, and it's freaking great. And do you have an opinion on this, or?
Yeah, I saw that the proceeds were going to the Epilepsy Society, like from the sale of the DVD and like donations that were made during the live stream or the restreaming or that. And I think that's really nice, just like a nice tribute to like Ian Curtis and really, you know, showcasing his legacy through like the Joy Division songs and then doing something to help people. Like him, you know, carrying his memory on. I think it was really nice.
Well said. Two more quick stories. East Bay Ray is releasing a new Killer Smiles record. The Killer Smiles is basically the Dead Kennedys. I know it's East Bay Ray. It's it's East Bay Ray. It's the guy, Skip McSkipster from Wynonna Riders and current singer of Dead Kennedys, and two other guys. You know, for years and years and years, the question was, why are the Dead Kennedys even touring without Jello? Why doesn't East Bay Ray just put out his own stuff? He put out his first record in 2011, or the Killer Smiles record, which I heard it. I dug it. I saw my I dug it. This is probably going to be cool. It probably isn't going to be amazing, but it'll probably be cool. Adam or Em, I don't know if you guys have any perspective on, is East Bay Ray doing the right thing by putting out a new solo record? Or should he just keep doing the Dead Kennedys thing? Or should he do both? Or... you know, it kind of piggybacks onto the Peter Hook thing, doesn't it, now that I think about it?
I think he should keep doing new stuff because, like, again, the Dead Kennedys, you know, everyone is really good, but, like, it was mainly Jello, like, for me, you know, anyway. Because, like, Dead Kennedys were, like, my band for so long, and then, you know, I haven't listened to any Dead Kennedys with Skip as the vocalist. So I think that East Bay Ray doing his own thing is like the only way to move forward and just be like, he's actually like, he has ideas. He has like different musical like arrangements and stuff. He should showcase it instead of just kind of like, oh, here are some songs that you know, were written quite a while ago and we're just going to keep, you know, playing them. And while that's good and everything, you know, I think he should branch out and do his own thing. I like the Killer Smiles. I think they sound pretty cool.
And how great are the Dead Kennedys? I was just listening to them yesterday. Dead Kennedys are so freaking good. So freaking good.
Like, you can never get tired of them. Like, that's the best thing. And they just work for, like, all moods, all days. It's just great.
I'm a huge Dead Kennedys fan. But even I admit, Frank in Christ and even, not take this job, Bedtime for Democracy. Those never really like bolted to me like, you know, the other records did. Were you able to get into those two albums, or did they just kind of exist for you and you check them out, but they don't like speak to you? You know what I mean?
Yeah, a few songs off of Frank in Christ, but not the whole album. And Bedtime for Democracy is just kind of there. Like Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables is like kind of my go-to.
Yeah,
but like they're all so good. Like
I need to check out Bedtime again because it all is like super short hardcore songs. But for some reason, it doesn't seem to click. I got to give it one more spin. Adam White, and any perspective on Dead Kennedy? I mean, Killer Smiles.
On the one hand, from a performance standpoint, he can have his cake and eat it here because he could tour as if he was touring as the Killer Smiles and playing original music from that band in the set. But also playing whatever Dead Kennedys song he wanted to, I don't think anyone would begrudge him for it. Like, if he got on stage and he was like, hey, I'm East Bay Ray, I'm going to play 3 Killer Smile songs and then 45 Dead Kennedys songs, everyone would be fine and into it and not complaining, and it wouldn't be a contentious thing at all. And, you know, there'd be a lot of love in the room or whatever. But the... because they for so long they went about this you know just this fight that the Dead Kennedys became throughout the 2000s in particular, in you know, everyone fighting in public about it and all of that, and, you know, different versions of the band with people that weren't Jello singing and all this coming about, just all of that. Like, oh God, like it was like, I feel like I was in the trenches for that, John. Like, that was my youth at Punk News, was just like trial by fire of different Dead Kennedys singers being mad at people and me and everything else. Right. It just like, what a different universe it would have been if Ray like didn't, I guess, allow himself to potentially get painted as a villain in this scenario, because I feel that that's one of the ways it was sort of phrased. So yeah, now I get the financial realities where, you know, if you show up in a town with the same group of people and you say you're the Dead Kennedys, then you fill a room. And if you show up and you say we're the Killer Smiles, then six people come. Right. So I understand that. And maybe that's too tempting a thing to avoid sometimes. But yeah, I'm encouraged by Ray recording and doing stuff on his own with his own band. Like, he should. I don't think I've ever listened to it before. I'm kind of stoked to go check it out.
I'm not going to get too deep into it. I think I told Adam about this in a non-recorded session. But people think of Jello as being the wild maniac, the crazy guy, the weirdo of the Dead Kennedys. The great M. Who
yes.
do you think is the weirdest member of the Dead Kennedys?
All of them as a group.
So that's a good guess. You might be right. East Bay Ray is so much weirder than Jello when I interviewed him. Like, it blew my mind. I have no idea how that band functioned. Like, you would think with Jello, the other three guys had to be totally normal to exist with this person. I think they're all maniacs. But like Jello, when Jello's the normal guy, you know, like, it's a weird scenario. Anyway, last story. Speaking of guys that are down to earth, guys that are just guys like you and me, you know, guys that are salt of the earth. Ice-T and Bodycount have released a video for "Point the Finger." It's pretty much a hardcore song. Not even a metal song. It's more like a hardcore song. It's off Body Count's new album, Carnivores. And Body Count has been, past 5 years, they've been releasing a lot of stuff. And Ice-T actually hasn't done a hip-hop record in, like, I think, like 15 or 20 years at this point, which is kind of really amazing, because at this point, hip-hop is way more popular than rock. Although that being said, within a certain community, metal and hardcore still are popular within that niche, if you will. Are you guys Body Count fans? Was this cool?
This was adorable. And not for reasons that I think anyone would think. My opinion about Body Count notwithstanding, Ice-T gets on video and like for the first like 2.5 minutes of the video, and he almost apologizes for them having to make like a quarantine video with iPhones, where like he explains it out like painstakingly to the viewer what you're about to see, where and he sounded like a little bit apologetic about it, almost in a way that was like that was cute, like in a way like he didn't need to do that at all. Like, everyone that's releasing videos right now are making, like, you know, shitty iPhone compilations of socially distanced stuff because there's nothing else to do, right? And I just think it was so funny to me that he had to stop and like explain that to the universe before the actual video started, like to lower everyone's expectations about what they were about to watch. And I'm like, that's not, you didn't need to do that, Ice-T. Everyone gets it. This is the world we're living in right now. Don't worry about it. I don't know. I thought that was super, super endearing to me to see him have to do that. Then there's a music video that happens after, but whatever. I think Riley Gale is hilarious in it, though.
And
yes,
Riley Gale of Power Trip teaming up with Ice-T.
Riley Gale.
Iceberg Slim. What'd you think of it?
Riley Gale was the reason why I just like looked at the video, because I really like Power Trip. And I was like, oh my God, they're going to be like so good together and everything. And then they're like his voice and then Ice-T's voice. And it just like, it blended so well. you know, I liked the song, and then like the video like had good parts in it. Like, isn't it one of the guitarists, like, does his kid or his dog or someone like come in? Is that that video?
Let me tell you, it might be Ice-T's daughter. He's got a youngish daughter. It's like 2 or 3 now.
Okay. Because I know, like, somebody is, like, performing, and then somebody, like, walks, like, kind of crashes their video. And I thought that was just the best. And then, again, like, Riley Gale, and it's just, like, primo. It's awesome.
I actually kind of dug this a lot. I love Ice-T's early hip hop album, Original Gangsta, Iceberg Slim album. His early hip hop albums are freaking great. What is it? Power. I've always wanted to like Body Count, but I just never had. It always seems kind of not quite to click for me, and it almost seems like a band trying to be metal or hardcore, but isn't really quite hitting the marks. I thought this was actually it's not reinventing the wheel or anything, but it's a standard hardcore track, and I thought it sounded really good. I kind of wish that like Body Count would just become a straight up hardcore band and just be like, you know, like Pro Mag / you know, modern hardcore type stuff. Luke Kohler. What the hell is the name of his band? Sick of It All. I wish Body Count would kind of just do straight up hardcore all the time. I'd probably be a huge fan. So I'm gonna go back and check out this record, man. So listen, man, Ice-T's a cool guy. I'm down. Anyways, you can always reach that podcast at punknews.org. M, you have any comments or anything you want the listeners to know about?
Just one quick thing. I checked the video. It's Riley Gale. He has his dog with him.
Ah.
That's what it is. Figured it out. Stay safe. Be careful. Wear masks.
Adam?
All those things. Particularly if you live in Ontario, like us, because we're not doing a good job. Shit.
No.
And we'll see you next week. Take Ice-T's advice.